Hi, everybody. I'm Beatie Covretos, and welcome again to the Ask Beatie Show. And the Beatles are not the only ones these days who are feeling down. People are really, really struggling with the pandemic and everything that has happened as a result of being isolated, of concerns of losing one's job and businesses. In fact, I have to say, in the last 6 months since March, of course, my entire private practice in New York City and in East Hampton is on Zoom. I have never, ever heard so many people feeling so helpless and worried and angry and scared about the future. And of course, the very, very, very best thing that we're able to do for ourselves when our depression and anxiety really starts to take over our life is to really reach out and ask for help. You know, when I began the Ask Beatie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network, it's almost 5 years ago. In fact, today is the 316th Ask Beatie Show on this network. My hope was that it was going to be a call-in counseling radio talk show, as I had done on many, many, many mainstream radio networks. So I am inviting you today that if there are things on your mind, if you have questions about your relationships, if you're feeling depressed, as so many Americans are, in fact, we're looking at statistics, 16 million adults in the United States, which translates into 1 in 5 Americans are suffering from depression. And each week when I look at the statistics, I know that these statistics are going up. 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders, again, exacerbated, not necessarily caused by the pandemic. But clearly, I mean, 52% of those people who are now working remotely are feeling more anxious. We're isolated. We want the human connection. We want to be able to hug somebody. We want to be able to walk around our neighborhoods without wearing masks, without the worry of contracting the virus, or of giving the virus, for that matter, to other people. So these are really tough times. And, you know, interestingly, last Saturday, October the 10th, was the World Mental Health Day. You know, and I was thinking, you know, it should not just be one day of the year or one week of the year that we are thinking about mental health. Mental health needs to be a part of our day-to-day lives because, you know, as I say, people are struggling. People are struggling not just with the issues that have been exacerbated by COVID-19, but by relationships, by financial issues, political issues. Everything seems to be so up in the air. People are, they're losing their businesses, their jobs, if they're lucky enough to have jobs. Jobs are changing. The fact that people are working from home, you know, I hear people saying, well, you know, it's kind of easier that we don't need to take the subway or we don't need to take our cars to go into the office. But basically, we are social beings. We are social animals. And the way we are living right now, it is not healthy. And yet, what do we do? What do we do given the reality of our situation? And of course, as I ask my patients every single day, that we need to be aware of doing all of the things, given the realities and the tumultuousness of life today, that are actually in our best interest, which of course means eating well and getting enough exercise and getting enough sleep and trying to remove all the toxins from our lives, including toxic people, and making sure that every day we take some time for ourselves to just really get away from the news and get away from all of really the bad news that we are hearing about, that we are reading about. on a day-to-day basis, it really does affect us. It affects us physically. It affects us emotionally. And this is where I think things like positive visualization and meditation and laughing and dancing and listening to music and trying to decompress can really make all the difference in the world, given the harsh realities of what people are actually having to deal with on a day-to-day basis. Parents, for example, so worried, so concerned about what to do about sending their children to school. I know here in New York, first the regulations were that the kids were going to be staying at home. Then there were changes. Then the children were going to be going part-time. Then they were going to be going full-time. And now almost every day or every other week, we are getting new information about what is going to be safe for our children. And what about the parents who still have to leave their homes and go to work? What to do with children who are having to go to school, study, get an education? Parents are juggling their own lives, their business lives, their relationship lives. And this is why when the going gets tough, we really do need to give ourselves permission and talk about our feelings and talk about our fears and talk about our scares and try to come up with some plans on a day-to-day basis that can actually help, even if it may not be huge gains, help to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. You know, I was reading recent statistics. Alcohol sales, for example, have jumped up about 75%. Wine sales up 66%. Beer sales 42%. Not exactly the best thing to do is to be consuming alcohol when we're feeling really down. As we know, or hopefully you know, that alcohol actually does happen to be a depressant. So again, I want to encourage you every single Monday here on the Ask BD Show that if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you're feeling depressed, if you're feeling suicidal, that you actually do give yourself permission to give me a call. And the call-in number here on the Ask BD Show is 888-744-8888. You know, I was reading a recent study just this past week for U.S. adults ages 18 or older. Depression symptoms were more than threefold during COVID-19 than prior to the pandemic. Lower income families having less than $5,000 in savings and having exposure to more stressors were associated with greater risk of depression during COVID. Drug overdoses increased in the COVID pandemic as opiate users found themselves alone without the usual safety nets. And so given the reality of all of the things that are going on, whether or not it's journaling, whether or not it's joining a Zoom 12-step group, whether or not it's being real with your friends, with your family, and saying, and again, not being embarrassed to say, I'm having a really, really tough time. And this is one of the advantages of being a professional athlete. Athletes have coaches and teams and managers and all kinds of people that can help them maintain their great toughness during times of stress. And I think that we all need to, again, understand that getting second opinions, having emotional coaches, having life coaches, at times having therapists is a really good thing that will help us, absolutely help us get through the really, really tough times. So I hope that I have convinced you, if you are sitting on the fence and you're wondering, should I call? Should I call a therapist? Should I call my doctor and let my doctor know that my physical health is also really being impacted by my depression, by my anxiety, by my suicidal thoughts, by my suicidal ideation. Again, we need to give ourselves permission to take care of ourselves, to take care of our families, and asking for help, particularly under very, very stressful times, is probably one of the best gifts that we can actually give ourselves. Well, moving on to another, let's just talk about it, memorial during the month of October. For those of you who may not know, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And again, domestic violence is something that we should not just be thinking about during the month of October. And for people who are unclear, what exactly is the definition of domestic violence? Well, it is the willful intimidation, physical assault, battery, sexual assault, and or other abusive behaviors as part of a systematic pattern of power and control perpetrated by one intimate partner against another. And so many people believe that when you talk about domestic violence, that it means only physical violence. However, it includes not only physical violence, but sexual violence, psychological violence, and emotional abuse. And the frequency and severity of domestic violence can vary dramatically. However, the one constant component of domestic violence is one partner's consistent efforts to maintain power and control over the other. And in this country, domestic violence happens to be an epidemic affecting individuals in every community, regardless of age, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, gender, race, religion, or nationality. And it is often accompanied by emotionally abusive and controlling behavior that is only a fraction of a systemic pattern of dominance and control. And of course, it can result in physical injury, always psychological injury and trauma, and in severe cases, even death. The devastating physical, emotional, and psychological consequences of domestic violence can cross generations and last a lifetime. So what do you think some of the statistics are? And these statistics are very shocking. And you know, one of the things that one would believe or hope is that with all of the podcasts and relationship shows and talks about therapy, that we would actually be seeing a decrease in the incidence of domestic violence. However, that is not the case. So what are some of the statistics that we're talking about? Well, 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence during her lifetime. And by the way, 1 in 7 men will experience domestic violence during their lifetime. And on average, 24 people per minute, when you think about that, are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in the United States. And intimate partner violence affects more than 12 million people each year. And women between the ages of 18 to 24 and 25 to 35 generally experience the highest rates of intimate partner violence. And more than 60% of domestic violence incidents happen at home. And it is the third leading cause of homelessness amongst families in the United States. So we are not doing well in this particular area. And I want you to know something too. The domestic violence, it is a learned behavior. It is learned through observation, which is why we see from one generation to another, unless somebody says to themselves, look, I do not want to continue to be as abusive as perhaps my father or grandfather was, and I am going to do whatever it is that I can do, including getting help, to stop the cycle of abuse in my life. It's learned through experience and reinforcement. It is learned in culture. It is learned in families. It is learned in communities such as schools, peer groups, and the workplace. And a lot of people also have misconceptions about why and how it is caused. Well, it is not caused by illness. It is not caused by genetics or alcohol or drugs or loss of control of feelings or anger or stress or behavior of the victim. It's so easy. And I've seen this for many, many years where the perpetrator will say, well, she made me do it. No, don't ever buy into that myth. And it is also not caused by problems in a relationship. Naturally, all of these things can exacerbate stress, exacerbate problems in one's individual life and in one's relationship. But the fact of the matter is, these are conscious choices that people are making when it comes to lashing out physically, sexually, emotionally. So we have to really have a clear understanding that it is never the victim's problem, and that the victim has never caused the perpetrator to act out. And something else I want to mention is that stalking can also be a form of domestic violence. And again, most domestic violence, as the studies tell us, is committed against women by their male partners or ex-partners. And it also occurs in lesbian and gay relationships and is common in teenage dating relationships as well. In fact, I was doing some research for a podcast. I'm going to be a guest on a podcast in a couple of days. The podcast is called Greek. So I was looking at some statistics about what is going on in terms of partner violence on college campuses. So listen to these statistics. About 1 in 5 college students report having been abused by an intimate partner. Women between the ages of 16 to 24 experience the highest rate of intimate partner violence. And we're talking about rape, we're talking about physical violence, verbal, sexual, and emotional abuse. And nearly 1/3 admit to having committed assault against their partner at some time in the previous years, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And if we're looking at causes in terms of intimate partner violence on campus, some of the causes: political, economic unrest, including racism, income inequality. People are really angry these days and are lashing out in all kinds of ways, verbally as well as physically. There's peer pressure and alcohol and drugs and stressful schedules and social media, mental health issues, and of course, history of abuse stemming from their own family of origin. And people who were abused as children, according to studies, oftentimes tend to abuse later in life. And what's also interesting is that 70% of young victims don't realize that they are being abused by their partner. And this is why relationship education is really so, so, so important. You know, there was an article that I actually found a couple of days ago. The title was, and is, The Truth About Domestic Violence on College Campuses. And recently, sexual assault at colleges and universities has been a major topic of discussion in the media. And when we talk about assault on college campuses, people automatically assume that what we really mean is sexual assault. However, many people don't realize how prevalent intimate partner violence can be on college campuses too. In fact, college-age women, again, between the ages of 16 to 24, have the highest per capita rate of intimate partner violence. 21% of college students report having experienced dating violence by a current partner, and 32% of college students report experiencing dating violence by a previous partner. So, of course, the questions then become, what do we need to do? Well, what I have found over the past 35 years as a practicing psychotherapist and sex therapist, and I would love to hear what you have to say about my own findings, is that there are three things I believe that we all need to do to keep ourselves safe in our relationships and be able to have healthy, sustaining relationships. And the first thing is that each of us needs to be in a good place ourselves, emotionally, psychologically, and psychiatrically. And we all have issues. And if we have skeletons in our closets, such as abuse of various different kinds that began in our own family of origin or in previous relationships that we've had, we need to deal with the problems. We need to deal with the past. Otherwise, we will always have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And if we are entering relationships because we are needy and lonely and we have poor self-esteem, we are putting ourselves into very, very unsafe and potentially dangerous situations, because we are then really not able to look clearly and honestly at the reality of our relationships, which is why we need to take care of our own business, and that we are entering relationships feeling good about ourselves, feeling healthy about ourselves, where we're then able, again, to choose partners and to be with people who are good for us. So that's number one. And number two, what I'm finding more and more, and I'm finding in my practice these days, many of my new patients are in their 20s and 30s, and they are brilliant, and they have graduated from Harvard, and they have graduated from Wharton, and they are in banking, and they are in tech, and they are brilliant in their fields. But the one common denominator that I am seeing is that these lovely, these are mostly women, know very, very little about relationships. And this is number two, where what we really do need to educate ourselves about what healthy relationships are and what relationships that are unhealthy, what they look like as well, so that we are clear. For example, if we're going back and talking about domestic violence, does your partner, for example, constantly criticize you and your abilities as a spouse or partner or parent or employee? That is domestic violence. Does your partner behave in an overprotective manner or become extremely jealous? I was talking to a patient of mine yesterday, and she loves to go to a coffee shop down the street from her partner's home. he doesn't want her to go. And he says, why do you need to go to a coffee shop? You can do your work in the home. I don't want you to go. Now, he has never been violent, but he is very, very controlling, very manipulative. This woman is very, very needy, does not want the relationship to end. And so this cycle continues. So does your partner also threaten to hurt you in some way? Your children, your pets, your family members, your friends, or themselves, or actually prevent you from seeing family or friends? You know, I think at the beginning of a relationship, you know, we want to feel that our partner needs us, and we want to feel that we oftentimes would like to spend the majority or at least a great deal of time in an exclusive relationship with our partner. But then as the relationship starts to play out, are you starting to actually see that the person who you assume loves you and who you think you love is actually wanting to keep you from seeing family or friends? Or what about, are you with someone who gets angry, suddenly loses their temper, throws things, and then apologizes or blames you for the fact that they've lost their temper, or destroys personal property, or throws things around, or denies you access to family assets like bank accounts or credit cards or finances, or even withholds medication or denies you access to health care, or forces you to work in jobs not of your choosing, or on the other hand, doesn't want you to work at all or does not encourage you to have the hobby or the hobbies that you love. What about this? What about your partner? Does he intimidate or manipulate or try to control you or your children, or hit or punch or slap or kick or shove or choke or bite you? And I've seen many, many, many situations like this over the years. And one wonders, well, why would somebody stay in a relationship like this? Well, the answers happen to be very, very, very complex, because it is extremely difficult for all kinds of reasons to leave an abusive relationship. And the other thing that I want to say about abusive relationships is that they are typically not abusive every single day. Now, I think of a patient that I treated a number of years ago. A lovely woman, educated. She walked into my office in Sarasota, Florida. And I was asking her about her marriage. And she said, look, she says, we have a really wonderful lifestyle. We're able to travel. We have enough money to do what we want to do. But a couple of times a year, my husband hits me. I said, what? He hits you? What happens? She says, well, you know, we go away a couple of times a year on trips, and he drinks too much, and we end up getting into fights. And it was only a couple of weeks ago that he hit me again. And this is why I called you, Beatty. And here was a situation. Here was an interesting situation where it was a couple of times a year. And this woman was wondering whether maybe a couple of times a year was not so bad. So when I see people for the first time, I really begin talking about people's families of origin, family backgrounds. And what did I about this woman's family background? And I think that many of you who have been listening to the show for the last couple of years, I think you will know the answer. Well, this woman, when she was a child growing up, was hit almost every single day by both her mother and her father. So in her mind, but it was a really good thing that she was starting to question that twice a year was not so bad as having been hit every single day when she was a child. And that was kind of what she got used to. And she was very embarrassed to tell me that her prior relationships, also before this marriage, also included abuse of various different kinds. So she learned very quickly that once was not okay, twice was not okay, and that she really had some distorted feelings about and thoughts about what a healthy relationship actually based on the fact that she herself grew up in a very, very abusive relationship. And I think it's important that we understand the dynamics of abuse. Again, that victims of domestic violence come from all walks of life, varying age groups, all backgrounds, all communities, all education levels, all economic levels, all cultures, all ethnicities, all religions, all abilities, and all lifestyles. And victims of domestic violence do not, and I want you to hear this, if you've ever been in a domestic violent relationship, I want you to hear this loud and clearly, that victims of domestic violence do not bring violence upon themselves. They do not always lack self-confidence, nor are they just as abusive as the abuser. So when someone says to you, "You made me do it. I lost my temper because of something that you did or didn't do," please do not buy into that myth. So violence in relationships occurs, and this is the underlying dynamic. When one person feels entitled, they feel entitled to power and control over their partner, and they choose to use abuse to gain and maintain that control. And in relationships where domestic violence exists, violence is not equal, even if the victim tries to fight back or instigates violence in an effort to defuse the situation. There is always one person who is the primary source of power, control, and abuse in the relationship. And the thing that is so oftentimes confusing to people is that the wheels of abuse are not constant. I mean, weeks and months can go by in domestic violent type of relationships where the periods of time are very, very calm, or they seem to be calmer. But those times are followed by a buildup of tension and abuse, which usually results in the abuser peaking with intensified abuse. And the cycle then often starts to repeat, commonly becoming more and more intense as time goes on. And remember, too, that each relationship is different, and not every relationship follows the exact pattern. Some abusers may cycle rapidly, others over longer stretches of time. Regardless, abusers purposefully, and that is the key word, use numerous tactics of abuse to instill fear in the victim and maintain control over them. And domestic violence affects all aspects of a victim's life, because when abuse victims are able to safely escape, and that, by the way, is another issue that victims are at most risk when they try to leave. So that when abuse victims are able to safely escape and remain free from the abuser, they often survive with long-lasting and sometimes permanent effects to their mental and physical health, to their relationships with friends, family, and children, their careers, and their economic well-being as well. Another thing I want you to understand is that victims of domestic violence experience an array of emotions and feelings from the abuse inflicted upon them by their abuser, both within and following the relationship. They may also resort to extremes in effort to cope with the abuse. Victims of domestic violence may want the abuse to end, but not the relationship. When you think about that, it makes total sense. I love him. I want this relationship, but not the abuse. And in most of these situations, that is not going to be possible. The victims feel isolated, depressed, helpless, may be unaware of what services are available to help them, and definitely are embarrassed about their situation. And embarrassment or humiliation of the victim in front of others, or harassment of the victim at work. And you probably wonder, I mean, you really wonder, why do victims of domestic violence stay? Well, when it is a viable option, it is best for victims to do what they can do to escape their abusers. However, this is not always the case in many situations. Abusers repeatedly go to extremes to prevent the victim from leaving. In fact, leaving an abuser, and studies really bear this out, is the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence. In fact, one study found in interviews with men who have killed their wives that either threats of separation by their partner or actual separations were most often the precipitating events that led to the murder. And a victim's reason for staying with their abusers are extremely complex, and in most cases are based on the reality that their abuser will follow through with the threats that they have used to keep them trapped. The abuser will hurt or kill them. They will hurt or kill the kids. They will win custody of the children. They will kill or harm pets or others, and they will ruin their victim financially, and the list goes on and on and on. And the victim in violent relationships knows their abuser best and fully knows the extent to which they will go to make sure they have and can maintain control over the victim. The victim literally may not be able to safely escape or protect those that they love. And a recent study of intimate partner homicide found that 20% of homicide victims were not the domestic violence victims themselves, but family members, friends, neighbors, persons who intervened, law enforcement responders, or bystanders. So yes, this is a very, very complex issue to understand. You know, other barriers to escaping a violent relationship include, but are not limited to, the fear of the abuser's actions will become more violent, and they may become lethal if the victim intends to leave. And what about unsupportive friends and family? Of course, that's a whole other thing. Most women that I have treated who have been in domestic violence situations never, never confided in their friends and in their family. They were embarrassed. They felt humiliated. And on some level, they blamed themselves. And knowledge of the difficulties of single parenting and reduced financial circumstances also are factors in keeping these women in violent relationships. And another confusing dynamic that goes on in these kinds of relationships is that the victims feel that the relationship is a mix of good times And it frequently is a mix of good times. The love, the hope, along with the manipulation, the intimidation, and the fear, the fun, the promises, the makeup sex, it's going to be different, and yet the pattern continues. And also the victim's lack of knowledge of or access to safety and support. Where will I go? What will I do? I don't have a job. I don't have family. I don't have friends. I have children. How am I going to support myself? And also the fear of losing custody of any children if they leave or divorce their abuser, or fear that the abuser will hurt or even kill their children. And of course, the lack of means to support themselves or their children financially, or lack of access to cash, to bank accounts, or to assets. And where am I going to go? Lack of really having somewhere to go. So all of this really plays in to the complexities of why women will stay in abusive relationships. And the list really, it goes on and on. Fear of judgment. How could you leave this terrific man? He is successful. He is handsome. And as I've often said over many, many, many years, that no one ever knows really what goes on behind closed doors. And it's easy to deny or minimize the abuse or make excuses for the abuser. He's tired. He was sick. He's working too much. He has mental health issues. And still often the love continues. Of course, this is not healthy love, but people will still say to me, I still love him. I love him when it is good. So again, we have to be so, so careful to not make any judgments about people who we know or who we have heard of, who remain and who stay in domestic violence relationships. And the characteristics of an abuser, anyone can be an abuser. They do. They come from all groups, all cultures, all religions, all economic levels, and all backgrounds. And yes, they can be your neighbor, your friend, your pastor, your child's teacher, a relative, a coworker. The fact is that an abuser can be anyone. And it is important to note that the majority of abusers, and this is something else that I think a lot of people don't know, are only violent with their current are past intimate partners. In fact, one study found that 90% of abusers do not have criminal records, and that abusers are typically law-abiding citizens outside of the home. So there is no one typical, detectable personality of an abuser. However, they do often display common characteristics, why it is so important that we rate our mate before it's too late so that we never make a mistake in love again. And this is why, you know, I continue to talk about my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. This book, which is based on research that I did with 450 adults, men and women, in the Providence, Connecticut, and Boston area. The book teaches you exactly how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. It's kind of like having me in your purse or in your wallet doing a very serious in-depth diagnostic assessment of your partner. And my research found is that it takes about a year, not a week, not 2 weeks, not a month, not marriage at first sight, you know, the show on television, to really find out who your partner is and who your partner is not. And unfortunately, what I have found is that this process cannot be fast forwarded. And as you play out the reality of your relationship, when there are differences, when there are problems, you are going to be able to get a very, very in-depth view of the reality of the relationship and the reality of your partner. And this is why, you know, when I talk about stop domestic violence before it starts, never make a mistake in love again, I think that we have to, if we are waiting for the other person to change, we may wait a very, very long time, which is why it is important, particularly for women, for us to be very proactive and very honest with ourselves about the reality of our partner and the reality of our relationship. Because the abusers, they often deny the existence or minimize the seriousness of the violence and its effect on the victim and family members. Oh, well, you know, I just had a really bad day. You know, I lost it, but this is really no big deal. Yes, it is a really big deal. When you find yourself in a domestic violence relationship again, it is not just the physicality, the physical violence that we're talking about. We're talking about physical violence. We're talking about manipulation. We're talking about sexual violence. We're talking about verbal assault, emotional violence. So it is a combination of a variety of different things that really come under the umbrella of domestic violence. An abuser oftentimes objectifies the victim and often sees them as their property or sexual objects, which is why our eyes need to be very, very wide open when we are dating and when we are getting to know the person who we think we may want to have a serious relationship with. An abuser typically has low self-esteem and feels powerless and ineffective in the world. He or she, mostly he, may appear successful, but internally they feel inadequate. And an abuser oftentimes externalizes the causes of their behavior. They blame their violence on anything, on circumstances such as stress, their partner's behavior, a bad day, on alcohol, drugs, or on other factors. So we as women, since the violence is perpetrated primarily against women, we must not buy into any of these lies and any of these myths. And remember too, that an abuser may be very pleasant and charming between periods of violence and is often seen as a nice guy, a nice person to the outside world. But there are a number of red flags and warning signs of an abuser that include, but are not limited to, extreme jealousy. In the beginning of a relationship, we may think it is really cool and really great that our partner is jealous or is possessive, but these are red flags that we really do need to pay attention to. Or unpredictability, or a bad temper, or verbal abuse, or extremely controlling behavior. And what about antiquated beliefs about the roles of women and men in relationships? We all know about misogynist men. Or someone who forces you to have sex or disregards your unwillingness to have sex for what whatever reason you don't want to have sex, it is never okay. It is never okay for your partner or anyone to force you. Blaming the victim, and this is so typical. I hit you, or I screamed at you, or I have been manipulative and I have been terrible to you because of the way you look, because of the way you behave, because you are not keeping the house clean enough, because I don't like the way you're taking care of our children. Blaming the victim is very, very common and typical. And don't buy into it under any circumstances at all. Also, sabotaging or obstructing the victim's ability to work or attend school, which is part of the isolation. And of course, again, the control of all finances. Here's another one. Accusing the victim of flirting with others or having an affair when it is not true. And what about, have you ever been in a relationship with somebody who wants to control what you wear and how to act and wants you to wear only certain kinds of clothes and wants you to wear only certain kinds of makeup and wear your hair in certain kinds of ways that they control? Or what about a situation, and I hope you have not found yourself in the situation where you feel demeaned either privately or in publicly, where your partner is putting you down. Again, if we look at societal barriers to escaping a violent relationship, despite how horrific a relationship might be, a victim's fear of being charged with desertion, of losing custody of children or joint assets, and also the fear of being alone, a lack of support by police officers and law enforcement people, or even family or friends. How could you leave him? How could you leave such a successful, attractive, lovely person? Again, nobody ever knows what really goes on behind closed doors. But if you find yourself what you really do need to do is find ways to reach out and ask for help. And what I found, and again, I'm always so interested in hearing from you, my loyal audience, is that I really believe that typically there are red flags and that there are signs when we are getting to know somebody, when we are dating somebody, that we oftentimes tend to ignore. We'll make all kinds of excuses. We want to be in love. 50% of the time, the relationship is great. So he only screams and yells and throws things, and maybe on occasion will hit me. And we make all kinds of rationalizations and all kinds of excuses. So I think that there are a number of things that I'm hoping that will be a takeaway for you, is that we have to be much, much more careful in the beginning of our relationships, that we keep our eyes very, very wide open, and that we do really good, honest assessments, regardless of how lonely we are, regardless of how much we want to be in love, so that we are not ignoring, that we are not ignoring red flags that inevitably will do us in if we put aside the reality of what is going on in our relationships. So I think that prevention is really the best possible remedy for all of us to avoid finding ourselves in dangerous relationships and finding ourselves in domestic violent relationships. But let's say that we haven't done good assessments, and we all make all kinds of mistakes, and many people have not really been interested in becoming students of relationship education, so that if you're finding that you are in a dangerous situation, all I can do is encourage you to reach out to therapists. There are hotlines that you can call, people who can give you all kinds of advice and guidance, how you can save yourself and how you can really save your children. And even though Domestic Violence Awareness Month is only the month of October, I mean, this is something that we need to be thinking about 12 months of the year, as is Mental Health Awareness Week or day or month. I think that we have to be spending a lot more time as a society focusing on relationship education, focusing on mental health, and it will certainly help to create a healthier and saner society in all kinds of ways. So I'm hoping that today's show has been informative, and if any of you are finding yourselves in a dangerous relationship, you can always reach out to me at the Progressive Radio Network. My website is bdcohen.com. And again, I hope that today's program, it hasn't been sexy, it hasn't been fun, it hasn't been uplifting, but I am hoping that it has been helpful for you. Because in the final analysis, it is our relationships. It is our relationships, I believe, that are most important in life. And we need to do everything possible to make sure that we find and maintain healthy relationships. So here we have another hour has come and gone here on the Ask Beauty Show. And I want to thank you all for listening. Your comments will be deeply, deeply, deeply and gratefully accepted. And I will talk with you next week and every Monday here on the Ask Beauty Show from 3 to 4 p.m. And I end the show each week with my favorite song, one of my favorite songs, and that is What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. And